All right, ladies and gentlemen, I want to welcome you to a Give a Shift podcast. Haven't done this in a while, but I'm very, very happy to be hanging out in Austin, Texas, at the AF1 Motorcycle Dealership. My friends here have given me a little bit of space because we got a special guest in town for a big show tonight. My friend Alonzo Bowden is here.
Hey, I actually just came here to do a show, and I thought we were going to lunch, and now I got to do a podcast. So here we are, people. Let's chat.
Well, I'll get you a sandwich on the way. So anyway, Alonzo, thanks for spending some time. And you've done a ton of podcasts. I was listening to this stuff with you and Rogan in the last couple of days and everything. And you talk about comedy all the time. I mean, that's the world, and that's interview is that.
It's what I live, you know.
That's everything.
And I always say the only thing I'm serious about is comedy. And it's fun doing it. I mean, Rogan's is a blast because Joe is smart, well-informed, and we're old friends. You know, I've known Joe for 20 years.
Yeah.
So it's we're just comics talking, and we talk about any and everything. You know, and that's what a good podcast is. A guy who had actually a pretty bad podcast years ago told me, he said, yeah, podcasts are the new jury duty. you have no choice. You will show up and serve. So
welcome. Well, thanks.
No worries.
I hope you have a good time in prison here. anyway, but we're here to talk about motorcycles, and that's
my other passion.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that you've been around for a while, and I wanted to ask a few questions about that. But first, just to back it up, and you were raised in New York, and you had a mechanical background because you went. It was a high school for.
Right. I grew up in New York. I went to aviation high school, learned to build airplanes, fix airplanes, got my A&P licenses, did that for, I was an A&P for 10 years, and then I was training guys for 3 years, and that's what led to the comedy, going from training, making them laugh, to just making them laugh.
Without all the hassle of safety wire. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So the were you riding at that point?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I started riding. As a matter of fact, I had a motorcycle before I had a car. My first vehicle was a Honda 404, you know, the little cafe bike. It was a 77 yellow, and I learned the hard way about not passing on the right. That was my first crash. This woman, I was passing her on the right going up to a light, and she turned into a driveway. And sideswipe me and blah, blah, blah. But anyway, yeah. So I started riding when I was 18. I would have started earlier, but my dad wouldn't let me get a bike when I was in New York. You know, wouldn't let me get a mini bike or anything like that. I mean, in New York City, they were totally illegal, but people still had them, and I always wanted one. So literally a lifelong passion.
Was there like the story in the family about, you know, the uncle getting hurt on a bike?
No, none of that sort of thing? No, it wasn't that. Whatever, him just being him.
Him being a dad, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, my dad wouldn't either. My dad was a urologist. So, you know, back in the 80s when I started being interested in, or 70s, I should say late 70s, when I was interested in motorcycling, that's when, like, GPZs were coming out and ninjas and stuff like that. And he was a urologist, so at the hospital, it would be some guy who racked himself up against the gas tank and smashed his balls into his ninja. So that's all he ever saw, motorcycling. I remember I was at the hospital once with him, and he introduced me to this other doctor, and he was like saying, oh, you know, Robert's interested in motorcycling, and, you know, and he was kind of poo-pooing it and everything. And this doctor kind of lit up, and he had a BMW motorcycle, and he was totally, you know, my dad just kind of sat there, and it all kind of backfired on him. And
well, if you like motorcycles, then that doesn't scare you.
Right.
You know, it's actually somewhere between comical and annoying to me that the minute someone hears you ride motorcycles, the first thing they have to tell you is the story of someone getting hurt or killed on a bike.
Right.
They feel obligated to tell you that. And usually I'll say, yeah, I heard somebody died in a car once. It's like, fuck off.
Yeah.
You know, really, it's like, if it ain't your thing, shut up.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't ask your opinion. You asked me, like, do you ride a motorcycle? Good. Let me tell you a bad story about motorcycles. Fuck off.
It's death by boredom. It seems to be like half the you know, people out there make that decision. And I think that's one of the things that's always going to be the appeal of motorcycling, is it's not for everybody. So I kind of like it when someone's anti-motorcycle because I'm like, okay, I no longer need to have that conversation at all. There's no gray zone.
Yeah, a lot of them wish they could ride. And then some people just, like my brother. My brother's a sort of gearhead, and he's definitely into cars and bikes. He's just like, nah, not my thing. Right. He doesn't knock it. It's just not his, you know, he's just never had an interest in it. Although he does want to come to GP one year. I got to bring him one year just to see that and feel and experience that. But, if you're a rider, you know, it's in your blood. Like, I couldn't imagine not riding. There was one period for about 3 years I didn't have a bike, and I couldn't wait to get another bike, you know. And it's, I couldn't imagine not doing it. I always say it, they're my escape vehicles. When I come off the road and I go home, one of the things I look forward to is that first ride, you know.
And that's it. I mean, you're on the road, what, 200? 59.
I never count the days because it would be too much if I counted how much, you know.
Yeah, it's a reality.
So it's like, nah, I work.
And I, you know, you've had me over to your house and you've got a few bikes now, but you just picked up a new Triumph yesterday.
This is a strange, or a couple days ago. This is a strange month. Now, motorcyclists will understand this month, but normal people won't.
Normal people don't listen to this. Right. So it's
I bought two bikes this month. So last year when they first announced the new Rocket Triumph, I went down and I put in my order for one, and I wanted the TFC, the factory custom, the top of the line one. I have the first Rocket, like I have an 04, and you know, people always talk, I'm always trading and buying new and this and that, and they're like, but people don't realize, I've had that bike for 15 years, like I've never, because nothing comes close to a Rocket, so there was no way to replace it. I bought the Touring Rocket, the Bagger Rocket, and I didn't really like it, but I've always had mine. So I saw this new one. I was like, I got to have the new one. I got to have bookends.
When that thing came out, you sent me a note, and it was the TFC one. Yeah. And I was like, you're going whole hog. I mean, that's a good looking bike.
So I put down my deposit last May, and then they were supposed to come out in November. And the dealer's like, nope, nothing yet. December, nothing yet. Then in the end of November, they got the regular ones, and they had one at the show, and I saw it. And meanwhile, I have a GS and a GS Adventure, which I love. That's the bike that if I could only have one motorcycle, it would be a GS Adventure, no question. All due respect to the Multistrada, of which I've had a couple, the GS just works for me. So,
great bike.
My BMW dealer had a leftover 2019 GS with all the bells and whistles, the billet kit, the you know, the HP accessories, everything. And he was offering a good deal. And I was like, what the hell? All right, I'll trade mine in and get the new one. And literally the week after I did that, the Triumph dealer calls and he's like, your bike's here. And I was like, son of a bitch, I guess I'm buying another one.
There it is.
I ended up getting both and love them both. The new Rocket is just amazing.
How different are they?
You know what it's like? It's like if you had an old muscle car.
Mm-hmm.
So say you had a 69 Camaro.
Right.
And then you drove a 2020 Camaro. That's how different they are.
So kind of the soul is there.
It's still the torque monster. I mean, that's what the Rocket is. Yeah. It's a giant engine. It's a torque monster. But now it's, I think they said it's 80 pounds lighter. It has all the modern electronics on it. The handling... The old one handles good, but you got to work at it. Like, you got to push it into a corner and, you know, you got to muscle it. This one handles like, I don't know if I'd say it handles as well as a Diavel, but if not, it's damn close. I mean, that's the closest competitor, but it handles super light, and the engine is amazing. The engine is, it's almost electric torque, if you can imagine that, you know, just that rush of power at any time and any gear. And I haven't even broken it in yet, so I haven't touched what it can do, you know. And of course the TFC is 180 horsepower, because the 160 horsepower and 160 foot-pounds of a regular one wasn't enough.
Yeah,
now, that's the thing about the Rocket. With the idea of the Rocket is like, it's never enough.
Well, the next step is like Boss Hoss, right? That's absolutely.
Next.
Yeah. But talk about a velvet hammer, that thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you've had a few different motorcycles, and you've done track days and stuff like that.
Yeah, I've ridden everything except dirt. I've never been a dirt guy. I've done a couple of. I did one class on dirt riding, and I did. Well, I did
was it the
Colin Edwards
yeah,
class
we did
with
Colin
you, the
together,
flat track,
yeah.
And then I did one off-road thing in Phoenix, which was kind of cool. But, yeah, man, I've had everything. Like, I did, we talked about it earlier, I went through the sport bike era.
Right.
You know, I had a CBR 600, a 900 RR, a Aprilia Mille, Ducati 1098, you know. So I went through all the sport bike stuff. I've done the naked bikes. I always will love naked bikes. My Tuono was great. And the only reason I gave up the Tuono was that period where Aprilia went through bankruptcy and all that, and you couldn't get any parts or anything.
I'm
you
familiar.
Know, you were right in the middle of that.
I kind of worked for them at that point, yeah.
So, but I did that. I did the naked bike thing. I had one of the first generation Multistratas that I stripped to a naked. That was a really cool bike. And then now
which those you can pick up for like $3,000 using right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they're so, you know, it's like the power now, they just feel underpowered from what they were.
Right. But that DS engine has got, because I had a GT 1000 and it was the same power plant.
Yeah.
And that motor had character. It had soul.
Let me tell you, I'm one of the idiots who had a Sport Classic when they first came out.
Yeah.
And then the 1098 came out, and I traded in my Sport Classic, and I got like $7,000 or $8,000 for it. And then 5 years later, they were selling for $20,000.
I know,
you're
making
me
cry, man.
Boom.
That Ducati.
Who knew?
That's the one bike where I'm like, damn it, I just shouldn't have sold that.
No,
thing, you
it
know?
Was a beautiful
was bike.
But when
bike.
The 1098 came out, if you were a rider, which I was at that time, and when people listening, when I say I did track days, I was slow. I've never been a fast guy. Like, the fastest I've ever been is in toward the front of the middle group.
Right.
That's, you know, I got friends who are super fast on track. I've never been that guy, but it was fun. But anyway, as a rider, a 1098 was amazing compared to the Sport Classic.
Right.
So you had to have it. And the other thing I miss about that DS engine is the dry clutch.
Mm-hmm.
I love that rattle of the dry clutch. That's what always makes me think about getting one. And about 2 years ago, I saw one. It was just like you said, it was like $5,000 for one of the first generation Multistrada S with the Olean's. But when I rode it, it's like ex-girlfriends, right? The memory is better than the reality. And there are women out there, so it's same thing with ex-boyfriends. Even though I don't know if ex-boyfriends, if the memory's even good, but
I don't think so.
When you go back and and ride a bike that you had years ago, you know, it's not the same.
I just, a little while ago, I had the modern version of your CB400F. I had that CB1. You remember
the
bike?
Yeah,
teal,
I remember
teal
the CB1.
Tank.
Yeah.
Love that bike. I bought it from my buddy Alan, and I lusted after that bike. Even though there was like CBRs on the floor, I was a service writer at Woods Honda here in Austin, and there were CBRs on the floor, but that CB1, man, it just had something about it. And I didn't come from like a mechanical background at all, so I couldn't articulate why I liked it. I just liked it, right? So anyway, I see Alan riding the thing, and I literally chased him to the futon store that he worked at, and I asked him, look, if you ever sell this thing, here's my number. Please call me, in pre-internet days, you know. And sure enough, a few months later, the guy called me up and we struck a deal. And I owned that bike for like 20-odd years. And my buddy Domingo also lusted after one. And he knew I had this thing. And he worked on me for about a year and a half. It took a year and a half. And finally, he bought it. And he did a real good job at diving in and redoing it all. And making it run right and everything. And I got to ride it at the Harvest Classic. And you're exactly right. It was just like, man, there was something that was just kind of missing, you know, from that experience that, and maybe it's because I've ridden a million bikes since then, or I don't know, but
yeah, it could be. I mean, yeah, it's the romance of it goes away.
Right.
You know,
that was my only bike back. That was like, that's all I had.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was it.
And
so now I've got too many options. You know that. So.
So I've ridden that. Now I'm into the adventure bikes. Like I say, the multis were great. Although when I first got the newer Multi. I think my first one was a 2011. And I didn't really like the front end. The front end felt light.
I never liked looking at that bike. Yeah.
The front, no, I mean riding it. It just felt light. Like I had a Diavel, which I loved. The Diavel's a great bike. And I rode the Multi for about 2 months, and I was like, nope. And I went back and got another Diavel. Mm-hmm. And I kind of regretted that because the first Diavel I had was badass. I had some friends at Ducati who gave me Termi pipes for free and all this stuff. And all that was on. And, you know, when I traded it for the Multi, of course, somebody bought that right away. But anyway, I've made that mistake a few times. I don't even count those. But all great. I had an oddball bike that was really good. The Megamoto BMW.
Which Megamoto. I know that name. What was it?
It was the Street Motard. Remember they made the HP2?
That's right.
Off-road. The Megamoto was the Street Motard version.
Did they sell four of them in America?
Yeah, that bike was really cool. When I got the Diavel, the Megamoto sat unridden for about 3 months, and I was like, I'm going to get rid of it. And I ended up selling it to a guy in New Zealand.
Really?
Yeah. It was a pain to get it shipped to him. But he, you know, it was a cool bike. But again, it was one of those bikes. It was big. You know, I'm tall, so it was comfortable and all. But it made 100 horsepower, which unfortunately today isn't much when you look at sport bikes. So right. it was a great bike. That's something I look around every now and then. I might buy another one if it pops up. The only thing is that when they do pop up, guys are wanting, you know, 20 grand for them. Yeah. So I don't know if I want to spend that much.
Yeah.
For an oddball toy, but that was a cool bike, and I would have to sit down and try to remember every bike I've had, but now I love the GS, I love the Rocket to the point where if I had to, I could just get by with those two.
Yeah. But you've got a few right now.
I have different versions of the same bike.
Is there a max number of bikes where you're like, this is ridiculous?
Yeah, I had gotten up to I think like 8.
Oh, shit, I'm embarrassed now.
It was, yeah. Well, you know, you're in a different position, right? Because for one thing, you have the room to keep them.
Nature abhors a vacuum.
And you have, and I don't know how your insurance and everything works, but I had like a lot of late model big bikes, which become expensive to just keep and sit around. So, and then some of, like, if I don't use something, I don't keep it. You know, I'm not a collector. And I don't have a place to collect. So I had, and it was really cool. I had a Boxer Cup, which was just a really cool looking BMW, but I hardly ever rode it. So I got rid of that. And then I tried the Bagger thing, and it just wasn't me. You know, you
bought a Chieftain, right?
I had the Chieftain Limited, which was beautiful.
Gorgeous bike.
But it just, I was like, maybe I'll go with touring bikes. So I got rid of that, and I got the Victory Vision. And the Vision would be great if I went touring because it was so big. But since I wasn't really using it, and it was like, this thing's just sitting around here. It's too big to ride around town, you know. So,
that's when we first met, was Sarah Timlick introduced us.
Yeah, that was way back when.
That was a while back. And it was at Black Bike Week out in Myrtle.
Right.
And you came down in the hotel lobby. And you just kind of like nodded at me, and you were chatting away with Sarah, and you kind of written me off as just some other asshole in the lobby. And then you realize like, oh my God, you're the Victory guy. You're the guy I'm borrowing a motorcycle from out here. I remember that.
No, I didn't borrow a Victory from you then.
No, that's when we met. I loaned you a Victory later on.
You loaned me the Victory at Americade.
That's right.
I borrowed the Vision from you.
And you got to ride a Slingshot, I think it was coming
around. A year or two later, I did the Slingshot.
Anyway, but I knew we got along because I had a camera with a big lens on it. And you're like, what are you going to do? Take a picture of the moon or something like that. And I said, and when you stood up, I said, what are you going to do? Just throw an eclipse in front of that thing? So we were laughing at each other right away. I knew we were going to get along just fine. But That Victory was a huge platform, and I got to imagine for a big guy like you, that was probably one of the more comfortable bikes.
Yeah,
for
it was
time.
A super comfortable bike. And you know, the thing about Victory bikes, they worked.
Yeah.
I understood why when Polaris started doing Indian, why they got rid of Victory, because the fit and finish and beauty, Indians are beautiful.
Yep.
And I said, if I walked into a dealer and both of those bikes were sitting there, I would spend the extra $2,000-$3,000 for the Indian. There's no way I'd buy the Victory, just based on the look and the finish and everything else and the electronics and all of that stuff. So Victory, it was a great bike, but people didn't know about it, you know. And
well,
the Vision,
that's exactly why Scott shut it down. Yeah, Scott Wine shut it down.
The Vision was this just weird oddball bike. You know, it was like a Goldwing with a V-twin. You know,
that was my favorite bike because it offended people.
Yeah,
and we were talking earlier that
it at all.
If people are in the gray zone in motorcycling and you absolutely hate that bike, it's Bozo the Clown and blah, 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 blah. I'm like, great. I know I don't need to talk to you about that thing anymore, right?
But it worked.
It worked fantastic.
Yeah, it worked. If you wanted to go coast to coast and be comfortable, or, you know, two people, like two up, like you're not bumping into each other. I mean, it was comfortable and it handled well.
Yes.
It handled well for its size, but again, just I wasn't riding it, so I got rid of those. So now I got the two Rockets, the GS, and I have the S1000XR.
Oh, that's a great bike.
Amazing bike.
Yeah.
And that was one that I bought. Like, I wasn't even looking to buy a bike. I was at the BMW dealer for something, and this guy was there, and he's just raving. He's like, "You haven't ridden? You got to ride. You got to get one of these, man. What the hell's wrong with you? You got to get one." So I took it for a ride, and I was like, wow. And, you know, people compare it to the Multistrada, but to me it was just more fun than the
Multi. That's like adventure meets hooligan.
Yeah, yeah. It was like, let's take our adventure bike frame and put our sport bike motor in it, and it works. So I've become a fan of BMW. You know, BMW bikes are the same philosophy as their cars, right? High-tech, comfortable, fast, not the fastest, but fast. And yeah, I like Beamers.
It's hard to, I mean, to really use the power on a motorcycle these days to be on the street. Like, in first gear, you're already breaking the law.
Yeah.
I mean, that's obvious, right? But to really get to enjoy that and going out, I know you don't, when you go on tours, you're pretty much by yourself, right? I know you like to break away.
Mm-hmm.
So do you, living in California, you just head out north, or where do you like to
ride? No, I mean, when I get to do it, I've gone north, I've done Vegas. The interesting thing about touring is I haven't seen my own backyard, you know. I've been up and down the East Coast. I've been across
your country, you're constantly gone.
But no, I'm talking about motorcycle tours. I'm talking about, like, when I get on a bike for a couple of days and do something, right? I haven't done Death Valley.
Really?
I haven't done the Grand Canyon. And these are this is my backyard. You know, these are two-day tours that I could do from my house, and I haven't done them. So I want to do those. Those are the rides I want to do. Last summer, I was doing a thing for Roadrunner magazine up in West Virginia at some ski resort up there. So I flew into Tennessee and rented a GS. And I rode from Tennessee up to West Virginia because I wanted to ride the Tail of the Dragon.
Oh, right.
That's what it was. It was not for Knoxville, Tennessee. So I go to the Tail of the Dragon and I rode it. And for those listening, you've heard of that road. It's, what, 300 turns and 11 miles and whatever. And people are like, "What'd you think of the Dragon?" And I said, "Yeah, I got to tell you, I'm a little spoiled. I live in California. So it's a nice road, but we got those."
Wait till you see my driveway.
we have those. Yeah. I mean, we got Mulholland Drive and Latigo and Bouquet and all these different, you know, Angeles Crest. So it was anticlimactic for me. It was cool, but I'll tell you what drove me crazy, what really got me mad. The Harley guys wouldn't let you pass them.
Yeah, there is a thing out east that I've gotten into a lot of trouble for, that sort of stuff, because there's the pack and then there's like this sort of, like, the tail gunner is going to is like protectionist on, you know, the pack.
Right.
And even though they're riding in a staggered formation where you can politely, like, sort of, you know, gently zigzag through and there's plenty of room to, you know, that they don't want that to happen. And I did that in Sturgis when I was riding a Victory, and there was a crew, they were following, not only was it like a pack of motorcycles, they were following a van with a trailer.
Right.
That was like their lead person was that. And I just got completely fed up. So I'm swiping away at the GPS and I see this road that kind of runs parallel to the thing, right? Well, GPS is a two-dimensional map. it didn't indicate that it was a dirt road that like ran the ridge up over the top. So I was on a Victory Kingpin, and I flat out hauled ass on this bike and was skidding around corners. I should have crashed 10 times, you know, and I pop out on the road just in front of these folks, right? And the same guy who was like, you know, like punching his fist in the air and threatening me and whatever, you know, somehow had gotten like around the front. He probably realized that, you know, they were going too slow or something. And I pulled up on the road just as that guy was coming up. And it was such a nice payback to have a bike just completely covered in dirt at that point. And all my luggage and everything was just covered in filth. And I must have looked like a Pigpen from, you know, going down the road with this, the dirt flying off in front of the guy. I don't get that mentality.
I got no beef with slower riders, but move out the way.
Just
and
be
you
polite.
Know, and the thing is, if like when I was on the Dragon, there was one guy coming through on a sport bike, and it was kind of fun watching him because he was good. It's fun watching a good rider go through. And like I said, I was on a GS, so I'm doing moderate speeds. But if you're on a Harley, a touring bike or something, and you're going slow, just move over. Let people, like, it's like California, right? We can still legally split lanes. And I'll be lane splitting. And then there's this guy flying up behind me. And I know him. I used to be him. Mm-hmm. I know him. He wants to do 80 miles an hour between cars at a stop. So I pull over and let him go through. Like, there's no need
A fraction of a second.
Right.
He's no longer a distraction
there's
behind
you. There's no need
you.
To I'm hold like, him up. There's sometimes a bike will go through. I'll be like, wait, I can't let him ride faster than me. But usually, and when it comes to speed, you know, we were talking about this. People are talking about bikes being too fast. And I'm like, no, they're not too fast. They're just too fast for you.
Right.
So let the sport bikes now, I think they're for experts or for kids. You know, it's like stunters, right? Whenever, those stunters, blah, blah, blah. It's like, whenever I hear someone complain about a stunter, it's like, oh, you can't wheelie. That's why they're idiots, because you can't do what they do. I can wheelie. Like, I went to wheelie school and did some of it, and I'm not a wheelie guy. I admire those guys. Is some of what they do stupid? Yeah, but it's supposed to be. They're kids. They're supposed to do stupid shit. You know, I always say, on a bike, if you live through your 20s, you'll be fine.
Yep. Yeah, you've gained enough experience to self-preservation.
In your 20s, man, you're indestructible, and you just do stupid shit. And I'm not saying that they should do it, but I'm saying that, you know, I've seen the packs of dirt bikes going through town back east, and it's not good. It is pretty dangerous, but on the other side, I get that. I get why.
You know what's so funny is like how parallel that is to like the post-war era. Right. And all these soldiers coming back from World War II and buying up surplus Harleys and making customs out of them. And that has essentially defined the bulk of motorcycling as we know it in the modern era right now.
Yeah.
So, you know, for a bunch of young guys who are, you know, it's not a pack as much as it is like a group of guys who share the passion the same way like a gang used to be that in the 50s. So here's history repeating itself again. And as an industry, we should be smart enough to like go, oh, this is clearly a thing. So can we go to, you know, a city that's, I know that's an issue in Philly and in Detroit and some of the cities out east. There's got to be some like massive old industrial yard where guys can practice wheelies and can, you know,
well,
and the city can buy it up.
They have nowhere to ride them, you know. So if you're like, I grew up in New York, right, in New York City. There's nowhere to ride a bike. If you had a mini bike or a dirt bike, there's literally nowhere to ride it. That's why they ride them on the street. And you know, they're going to do it. They're going to ride because they want to ride. So now they're doing wheelies in the street. And it is a pack. It is a pack of them. And they're tying up traffic and they're breaking the law, which is unfortunate. But they have no alternative. So, yes, like you said, if you gave them somewhere to ride, maybe they do that. If you gave them the abandoned industrial park or, you know, a giant parking lot somewhere, they would use it. But I remember seeing a road race done in the parking lot of the Nassau Coliseum on Long Island. And wow. I was like, that's cool as hell. They coned it off and they had a little track and they were doing their track day out there because that's what they have. They don't have there's no track convenient to get to. If you live there, you know.
They used to race in Austin downtown. Did you know that? Motorcycle, Aquafest it was called. And Kevin Schwantz used to race. And his old man had to have a couple of wooden blocks because he was such a little kid. And he always had to grit at the back because he was his toes were on these wooden blocks. So the flag would go and he'd go take off and dad would grab these two hunks of wood, pull them out of the way.
So, yeah, but that's riding. I mean, you talk about, I know this is an issue for you, getting the next generation riding. But, you know, it's the same issue with cars and everything else. I mean, the next generation is digital. And they're having fun with their digital devices, and they're not into vehicles.
But I think it's because they haven't been exposed to it. You know, you can't fake an analog experience like controlling the wind. You know what I mean? And so all of a sudden, I mean, in Austin, I stood on one corner. Pam and I were walking around South Congress, and there were 8 different types of like last mile solutions. All of them had 2 wheels.
Yeah.
Every single one of them, right? But there was not one familiar motorcycle logo on that. And it just doesn't, it seems to me like there's a huge opportunity there to kind of latch onto that.
There might be. But see, if you're doing one of those little scooters, one of those bird type scooters or whatever, you have no connection to a motorcycle doing that. You
not
know what
yet.
I mean? That's just a scooter. And it's just to get from point A to point B. I mean, you know, the Groms and the little bikes are selling, the little 250 and 300 cc bikes are selling because kids can afford them and they're kind of fun and it's faster than a scooter. It is a real motorcycle. But I don't know how you get the next generation. Like I've been saying, you know, they want another "you meet the nicest people on a Honda" campaign.
Well, I mean, that's one of the things that you've seen me swinging the Strider hammer.
Yeah.
I mean, that's it, right? When there's a, you know, I don't play basketball, but there was a rack of basketballs in elementary school in PE class. So I get the fundamentals of the game because, you know, I was taught that, first, second, third grade or whatever. And if right next to that was a rack of Striders hanging there and every kid in that school had a chance to learn just by the natural force of numbers, we're going to create our own audience for motorcycling.
Yeah. You know? Listen, I get it, but I'm a bike guy. You know, the other thing you have to look at, I mean, now they're just looking at you like if you have an engine, like, what are you doing to Mother Earth? You know what I mean? Like, really? I mean, that's a thing, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like the Prius, right? Like, I hate the Prius. I can never have a Prius. But people drive Priuses, tons of Priuses,
yep.
Because to people it's transportation, it doesn't use any gas, blah, blah, blah.
It's utility.
It's, right. You know, somebody told me, and I really, he really nailed it when he said it. He said, well, of course you don't like Tesla. It's not a car, it's an appliance.
Right.
And I was like, yeah, I never thought of that, but it's like, yeah, that's
what
it is.
Yeah, but we only appeal to, what, 5% of, you know, people who are into transportation anyway.
Right.
So it's like, who cares? Who cares about 50% of the people out there? Right. If we can, you know, do a few of the right things and get us from 5% to 6% or 7%, you know, then it's all of a sudden like everyone's making their Christmas bonus.
Well, listen,
at that point,
the 5% is dropping.
Yeah,
because
it is.
The whole Harley market is dying off. Literally.
Yeah.
And Harley can't figure it out.
They've had so many options.
They can't figure out how to get young people on Harleys.
Yeah.
The live wire ain't going to work.
I agree with you that the Livewire as a product isn't going to work. I wrote an article on LinkedIn that the Livewire was the first motorcycle ever designed specifically to ride down Wall Street. That was its entire mission, was to go down Wall Street just to get like investors to go, oh, they are doing something. You know, that was really the fundamental mission on that thing, right? And then at a certain point when they hadn't come up with anything new, it's like, oh man, we kind of got to do something, right? And I know a couple of the guys, John Beckefee and Aaron Frank, who you might remember from Motorcyclist.
Yeah,
Aaron's a great guy. So he's working for Harley now. Mm-hmm. And he's working on the small electric bikes, right? Now, that guy is pure enthusiast. I mean, through the core enthusiast, right? And that gives me good hope that they've got something coming on the smaller, approachable side, because that was, you know, Aaron had fun with anything that had 2 wheels and a motor.
Right.
He enjoyed it. So I feel like, oh, they at least got one guy in there I know that's really into it. And I saw him at the Chicago IMS show, And he brought a bunch of the Harley executives and stuff. And I, you know, while I had him, I jumped right up on the bandwagon and I'm like, you know, yelling about new ridership and all this other stuff. So I feel like there is a crack at it, but man, they are definitely late to the game. And they, I know they're feeling the pressure there.
Well, I went to the Harley Museum while I was in Milwaukee. That was very cool.
Yeah, I don't know. You've never been a fan, but you got to appreciate
I'm not, you know, I'm not anti-Harley.
That, exactly.
It's just, it is what it is. Right. I get it. I think the whole, you know, the I'm going to beat you up culture is ridiculous, right? The, the whole tough guy.
Yeah, especially when it tapers off at about 5:30 on a Sunday.
Get
it's like,
yourself,
oh, I got to go to work.
You know, that, that kind of, it's actually stupid. And the embracing of that culture is what kills the company.
Yeah.
Because you can't.
It's also what saved the company, ironically.
It's,
though.
Yeah, it saved the company, but you had to look. You got to. They weren't thinking past that because now one of the reasons you're not going to be able to sell a live wire or any small electric bike because if you're a 20-year-old, you know, college kid or whatever, or you're a gamer, video gamer or whatever, and you want to buy one of these bikes. You walk into the Harley dealer, there's a bunch of old guys in leather with long beards making fun of you, blah, blah, blah. You turn around and leave. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not coming here to get insulted by, you know, to spend my money, right? So I think if Harley wants to sell those bikes, they got to come up with a sub-brand and a different store. You know, that's how you're going to sell that, you know, just like... Like Toyota and Lexus, right? Like in Japan, it's all Toyota. Mm-hmm. But in the U.S., for an upscale brand, they were like, well, nobody's going to spend $50,000, $70,000, $80,000 for a Toyota. So they created Lexus so that people would, oh, well, I'm buying a Lexus. It's like buying a really nice Toyota. But it works, you know, that kind of branding works. So, I mean, I got nothing against Harley. I wish them luck. But wake up.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, ooh, the Milwaukee 8. Like, yes, welcome to the 80s. Four valves per cylinder. That's genius. Yeah. But you have a customer base that gets mad at you for modernizing your product.
So well, it's got to be the most. They listen to that opinion too much.
It's got to be the toughest thing in the engineering department to say, yeah, you can't make it too nice. Can't make it work too well. The customers will get upset.
Well, the guy, Rich Kristoff, the guy who designed the Indian Scout, he was the lead guy behind the Indian Scout. And that was a really progressive, like, positive step for the Indian motorcycle brand. So you can imagine the Scout through the, like, you know, Indian didn't exist in the 60s and 70s and 80s, right? But when you look at an original Indian Scout and then you look at the current Indian Scout, there's like a sense of continuation. Mm-hmm. You know, he did a really good job of that, right? Well, Rich Kristoff was actually the guy who penned up all the, like, the Harley 48s and all, you know, all that, like, that stuff. Yeah. And he was working with Willie G at the time. So imagine the pressure of that, where it's like you got somebody looking over your shoulder saying, like, no, you can't mess with that one. You know, at what point are, like, you're down to fork boots and mirrors and flat paint. That's all we got left, you know? I was like, what are we going to do here? So, you know, I definitely wish those guys luck. I think there's no other brand on the planet that can elevate motorcycling if Harley were to just make that right move. I agree with you on
that. Well, you know, you mentioned Indian, and I had one, and I love Indian. Here's an idea. You want to grow market share? Open some dealerships.
Yeah. It's tough.
There's not an Indian dealership in Los Angeles County.
That's brutal, isn't it?
Think about that.
Yeah.
How dumb is that? Yeah. No, it's not brutal. It's dumb.
Yeah.
It's dumb. Open a store. I know you got to have $1 million to open a store. And it is. No. As a factory, open a store. Los Angeles is the biggest motorcycle place in the country. You've got all the stars and the celebrities. You got all the glamour and glitz. Put them on Indian. Get Indians out. You know what I mean? Like, Indians are great bikes. But if you want to buy a bike, and this is one of the things that Harley really does well, there's a Harley dealership in every town.
Right.
Some places, you know, if you're in the middle of Kansas or whatever, you know, Midwest, Iowa, whatever, you might want a Ducati, but then you got to go a few hundred miles to buy it and to get it serviced. Whereas the Harley dealers, at most one town over, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, Indian, since they want to appeal to that same market, that bagger V-twin traditional market, you got to open some dealerships. I mean, when I had my Indian, the fact that I had to go to Orange County to get it serviced or get a part, And for those listening, you're talking about a 2-hour drive dealing with LA traffic.
Yeah,
if you have to put your if you have to put your bike on a truck or a trailer and take it from LA down to Orange County, you're 2 hours in traffic. Utterly ridiculous.
Yeah. I agree with you. I agree with you. And you know what? I mean, I know when I worked for Aprilia, and this is probably, I can't speak to this for sure, but this is probably the case with the Ducati store over there. But the store in New York is augmented or assisted by the factory at some level.
Yeah.
Right? It has to be. So the same sort of thing can happen in LA. And ironically, they just, Polaris just pulled out of the, or they're shutting down the factory stores in New Zealand or in Australia, excuse me, because they were essentially, there were, you know, subsidiary owned stores and they're going to a private dealer network. In the States, it's tricky because of franchise laws and the way that the stuff is written for a factory to open up. That sounds, so Elon Musk has figured it out and I'm like, come on, we got to be able to do this.
Well,
so I agree.
You may not be able to open it, but you can finance it.
That well, yeah, absolutely. You can back it up.
You
for
can
sure.
finance
yeah.
it. So you could have somebody who's maybe a multi-line dealer or a different high-end brand, like in, you know, in Vegas where you have Ducati and Indian, two high-end niche brands at the same dealership because you're appealing to a certain market, right? A certain demographic or whatever. And I mean, I'm not a business guy, but as a consumer, I'm telling you, as a consumer, if I buy, I'd like to be able to buy the motorcycle. So if I see an Indian and like, wow, that's really cool, I'd love to be able to buy one. Mm-hmm. You know, and I know people at Indian. Indian makes great bikes and they got good people. But it seems to me, that seems to me like a very simple thing to do, and it's got to be a, you know, a dealer or dealer network in LA County where you're like, yeah, we need you to sell Indians.
Yeah, well, yeah, and I think they finally have enough of a product diversity, you know, now that the FTR is in there and you know, the variations of the Scout and stuff like that. They're never going to have as many SKUs as Harley Davidson does. I mean, I've never.
But they're not trying to.
No,
they're not trying to. You know, Honda. You know, Honda needs to come up with something. Honda hits every now and then. They hit with the Grom.
Yeah.
The new Goldwing works, but I don't know how much it's selling. It's a great bike, but I don't know how much it's selling.
They really tried. You remember the commercial when that one came first came out with the woman, you know, riding with her guy on the back, and that was I know so many female motorcyclists, right? And they were just like, "Hell yeah, that was, you know, that was super cool." That, but that wasn't like a sustainable
thing, you know, the thing with the Wing, you have such an, it's such an iconic bike and it's such a specific market. They should have kept the big Gold Wing and made the smaller one. You know, like the new smaller, sportier one almost replaces the ST. It's almost, you know what I mean? So, yeah, I understand you're going, and they were going for a younger market. So, yeah, I understand you might want to get the guy who's 40 years old, who's given up his sport bike and say, hey, you can still have fun riding a Goldwing, but you got your core market, who is the two retirees who want the Goldwing and want to put a bunch of lights on it and tour and everything. Keep a big one for them.
Yeah.
They, you know.
Because you had a Rune.
I had a Rune, yeah. That was because I love Valkyries. I love power cruisers.
Right.
The problem with the Rune for me, I'm a rider. It was too much to polish, too much to clean. The bike worked well, but man, as a, I mean, it was a lot of chrome on that thing.
Is that, that's why you got bad knees, right? From just getting down.
Puddle. Yeah. You go through a puddle and it was like, yeah, I got to clean. That's what led to the Rocket.
Oh, yeah.
I got rid of, I traded the Rune for the Rocket and I was like, damn, the Rocket's the only bike that could out Valkyrie to Valkyrie.
You know? There's a, the guy who owned Miller, who owned the racetrack out in
yeah, he had a bunch of Runes, right?
He had a pack of them, right? And then you mentioned on Rogan that Clooney bought
a bunch of them, for him and his buddies, right? It was a fun bike. It was a fun bike. But it was, for me, again, it was just the idea of cleaning it was a pain in the ass, you know? And I always said, and I will, one day I'll own a Goldwing. I don't know when. One day I'll get a Goldwing. Because they do work. They're the best. It's the best touring bike there is. You know, it just works. There's nothing like a Goldwing.
I tell you, a Goldwing with a set of pipes on it sounds pretty bitchin'. That flat six sounds cool.
There's guys who are ripping on Goldwings, but that's not what it's for. You want to be comfortable, you know, and just tour, just cruise, just go.
You've got a joke that You're a black man over 50 years old. You only got 10 years left anyway,
right?
Yeah,
that's right. I got 10 good years left. So one of them's going to
So
you know, I used to say I was going to get my wing when I hit 50. And then I hit 50, so now I'm like, I'll get my wing when I hit 60. You know?
But pushing it right to redline there.
The wing, I like it though. I like the BMW. The problem with the BMW is the seating position sucks. You know, motorcycle companies, KTM is the only one that figured out like you should make it adjustable.
Yeah. Yeah, you rode my 1290 when we did when we went to Colin Edwards.
You know, and they do something like BMW has a high and low position on the seat, which gives you about an inch.
Right.
Harley, you can adjust a Harley to the height, but you got to spend thousands of dollars to do it. But to their credit, you can do it. You can buy forward controls or different seats, different bars or stuff like that. You know, like when you get in a car. Right,
the seat is adjustable.
Yeah. The steering wheel's adjustable. Some of them, the pedals are adjustable, and you make it comfortable for you. On a motorcycle, it's like, okay, so the same person is supposed to ride this from, like you say, from a woman who's 5 foot six to a man who's 6 foot five. It's ridiculous. So, 2 inches of peg adjustment on a bike is a huge difference in comfort.
You know, KTM on their RC8. The subframe bolts,
right?
You know, you could move the whole subframe up and down. There was enough slack in the wiring and the bodywork.
They're the only ones who really figured it out.
Well, that's because they're all enormous Austrian, you know, former tank commander types, right?
I mean, it makes sense though.
Yeah,
it makes sense.
You know? No, it's cool. I've been enjoying having, you know, you're making fun of me for buying these TW200s and stuff like that, but I've always loved small bikes, the approachability and the fun of little bikes. And I think that that's actually a potential big savior in the motorcycle industry. But we don't treat small bikes with the same respect that we do, you know, the big.
Well, United States, you know, in America, bigger is better.
Right.
I mean, cars, they deal with the same thing, right? They sell more SUVs than, you know, Volkswagen Golfs or whatever. And we only need a Golf.
Yeah.
But you buy an SUV. You know, the F-150 is the number one selling vehicle in America. 80% of those truck beds will never carry anything, right? That's just the way it is. That's just American marketing. And we have more space. Again, like you were talking with your friend, but when you go riding in Europe, you know, and you take a Goldwing through Europe, it's like, man, this thing is huge. Like the roads are, you know, because the roads are goat paths and they were built for horses thousands of years ago. In the U.S. and the American West, you got all the room in the world.
Mm-hmm. That's
so
true.
So you get something big. Yeah. You know?
Have you gotten a tour in Europe?
Not on a motorcycle. No.
No?
Not yet. It's on my bucket list to fly to Europe and, you know, get a bike and ride. I rode in Australia. That's the only place.
So what's on the top of the list in Europe?
There's a ride where you do the Italian Alps and you go down to Monza for GP.
Oh, nice.
So I'd like to do that one.
On a GS, I would assume.
They have different bikes, but yeah, I'd probably
pick a GS.
Yeah, I'd probably want. Or I might get a Multistrada just because, you know, you're in Italy and try to blend in.
Fair enough, but I think there's a lot of BMWs in Italy, man. I'll tell you that.
Beamers. Yeah.
I got to do a tour out there and we rode up through the Italian Alps. We did a lap around Lake Como. And I was with a celebrity guy and you know, I was working with Aprilia and we had fun. I was with Matt LeBlanc and we got to go to the Guzzi factory. Mm. Did I tell you the Guzzi story about the vintage bike? So I'll tell you, this is great. So, so we're staying at a place we go, you know, and I'm like dragging the guy. Come on. We got the Guzzi. It's factory. It's right here. Mm-hmm. We got to go check. And Matt was into like performance and speed and motocross and all that stuff. And Guzzi just seemed like old and antiquated and weird, which it is. And so, we go over, I finally get him to go over there and I'm like, I got to keep it entertaining. So we absolutely just tear ass through traffic, zip, you know, around. And me and another guy are on Tuonos, and he was on a Futura. And so anyway, I'm ripping around. We get over to the Guzzi factory, and it's like the doors open up. There's a big red gate, and it says Guzzi on the front, right? Doors open up. There's this huge poster of Sean Connery. Right behind the gate, right? Of like him on a Guzzi. And it's just like, Matt's got respect for that guy as an actor, right? And he's like, oh, wow, what's going on there, right? And Friends was huge in Italy, right? And Joey was the favorite character out of all the. So, of course, they, you know, Ivano Beggio owned the company at the time. They blew the doors open for us. We got to tour everything. Brian and Getzy had the custom Guzzis that they were running out of there. So Matt gets on a Brian and Getzy bike, puts his baseball hat on backwards, rides up to the test track that's on the roof of the of the factory, and is zigzagging around old crates and nails and all this stuff, right? And then we do a tour through the museum, and there's, man, I mean, talk about stereotype. There was the Italian curator. I can't remember his name, but he had a white lab coat on with the, you know, Guzzi logo on it and everything. And they had this bike that Tenney himself had ridden at the Isle of Man, and the paint was all cracked and everything. And he's explaining that they had the bike out for a, you know, like some show or something like that. And Matt's like, that thing didn't run. You know, he's just giving him shit. Mm-hmm. There's no way that thing runs. And the guy just like peacocks up and he's like, of course it runs, you know? Anyway, so we continue on the tour. And about 15 minutes later, they have a tiny little elevator that takes the motorcycles up and down. And about 15 minutes later, we hear this huge roar outside in the alleyway, right near the big, Connery poster. And we stick our heads out of these little slot windows up on the third floor of the museum looking down. And there's the guy like revving. It's got big, heavy crankshaft, right? And so we book it back down to the bottom, and Matt gets to rev it up, and the guy's like, okay, that's enough, right? And we're kind of standing there appreciating this moment, because it was just one of those things where you're like, this is a cool motorcycle moment. And the guy, almost without breaking contact with Matt, he reaches down and he picks up a fleck of maroon paint that had jumped off the gas tank, that is old enamel paint and had cracked off the gas tank. And he gives it to Matt, puts it in his hand, and he says, souvenir. And Matt had that piece of maroon paint up on the mantle at his house for years afterwards. And then at some point they remodeled the house and somebody swept it up and it disappeared. But that, I mean, that just speaks to like the passion and you know, I guess why we keep getting drawn to Italian bikes, you know, on a regular basis.
Well, Italian, everything Italian is Italian. So it has style. It has a certain panache to it.
Yeah,
you know.
Exactly the word. Yeah.
And it's just really cool. It's just inherently cool.
Yeah.
Ewan McGregor is a big Guzzi guy.
Yeah, yeah,
huge
he is.
Huge Guzzi guy. A guy who's a mechanic for him, who's also a Grom guy. That's how I met him. But, you know, like when you talk about a culture, you know, the Grom, when Honda did that, they had no idea. Like, they stumbled into a whole culture.
Yeah, you went to that press intro,
oh,
didn't you?
Oh, man, it was fun. The press intro to Grand Prix. And now the Ruckus was the big thing. People got those Ruckus scooters and they'd flatten, you know, slam them to the ground, put big tires on them. So now they used to call those the Ruckout. You'd meet at a Ruckout. Now it's the Grom thing. So now you go to the Ruckout and there's an equal number of Groms. And you know me, my favorite thing is fat guys on Groms.
Yeah.
You know, and I see 300-pound guys on Groms. I'm like, you're the coolest guy here. You know, you don't give a shit. You weigh 50 pounds.
You may look like you're
bike.
Excreting that motorcycle out your backside, but...
Big guys love Groms.
Yeah.
So, and it's what you said. It's more fun to be on a slow bike going fast than a fast bike going slow.
Wow. You know? Well, that's the TW200 is going to be a slow bike
that's
going
a slow.
Slow
bike, you go fast.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, not, you know, I joke them because I have one of mine is an early generation one. It's got drum brakes on the front. And I need to find one of those 80s style ABS stickers because no matter how much you pull the front brake cable, it will not lock up. Absolutely won't lock up. So, well, buddy, I appreciate you spending some time talking about motorcycling. I encourage. You know, you guys out there listening to Give a Shift, Alonzo is a guy who really gets it. Oh, one thing I wanted to talk about before we really end this, but you've got stand-up sets for you know, everything you do. And we talked once about, because you do Americade.
I love Americade.
That's the only place you can do, like, a set of motorcycle comedy, though.
Well, it's my culture, right? So Americade, to those listening, it's a big touring rally up in Lake George, New York, northwestern New York, and it's the first week of June every year.
Yeah.
So they asked me to come, I don't know, it's been 5-6 years ago at least, And they said, hey, will you come do a show? So I went up there, and the show, I just started joking about everybody's brand, because that's the whole thing with bikes. And at Americade, you had Harley guys, you got the BMW guys, you got the Goldwing guy. And when I say guys, it's guys and women, because sure. I love women riding, and more of them are doing it. But you had those groups, and then you had a smaller group of Kawasaki and a few Yamaha and Guzzi and random. And I would just make fun of all the brands and the clubs. I'll never forget, my favorite club was this group of guys from Milwaukee. They called themselves the Wild Hogs. And none of them had a Harley. It was the funniest thing. It was
Did they start on Harleys?
No, and then no. They just took that name. I said, wait, you're from Milwaukee. You're called the Wild Hogs. And none of you has a Harley. They had like Kawasaki's and stuff. And it was hilarious. But it's really fun. And Americade is a really cool vibe, man. You know, again, I'm all over in the cultures, you know. This is the funny thing to me, and this is why I make fun of it. Motorcycling, people don't realize how small a group we are.
All right.
Right? You talked about the 5% thing. Like, people say to me, why don't you do a motorcycle show? We pitch motorcycle shows. There's so few people watching mm-hmm. that to a network, they're like, it's not worth it. So you have this small group, and then the funny thing is, within this group, you actually fight each other. So yeah. You have the Harley versus, you know, well, Harley versus everyone, but you have, you know, BMW, and it's like, you understand, we might as well hang together, you know? And so, yeah, so I can go to MotoGP and hang with the race guys, and I get it, although I'm not as much of a race guy as I used to be. But then I can go to Americade and hang with the touring people, and I get that too, you know? And then you have stuff like here, like the bike show, the hand-built, is phenomenal.
Unbelievable.
It's really cool. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's all part of, we're all part of the same group, and the infighting is comical.
It reminds me a little, I've never been in the military, but it reminds me of the military, where Air Force guys will make fun of Army guys.
And, oh, yeah,
so,
and, yeah.
But I do those shows too. Ultimately, when it comes to like a mission, it's like we're all on the same mission.
Right.
And I know I have stopped on the side of the road to check on a Harley guy or a Honda guy or whatever. I see a bike on the side of the road and I got a van, I got a space in it or whatever. I'm like, hey, do you need... You need help. You need something, mm-hmm. right? And check in. So there is that camaraderie. It's like we've all chosen to do this thing, to ride inherently unstable devices, that if one guy years ago hadn't invented the center stand or the kicks, they'd all be flopped over on their side, right? So,
well, one of the cool things with Americade is more and more sport bike people coming up.
Right.
They ride up on Friday and
younger
Saturday.
Guys now?
Yeah. They come up on Friday and Saturday from like Philly, New York, where you can ride up there in one day.
Yeah.
Because every night is like a bike show mm-hmm. on the main street, you know. And they come up, and that's kind of, it's kind of cool. But yeah, I love Americade, and it is. Yeah, that's the comedy show I can do for motorcyclists.
Man, you know what? I've been to Americade a few times running demos for Aprilia when I did that. And Indian never went out there, unfortunately. I think it's one of the most beautiful places.
Oh,
in the country. The riding is amazing.
Beautiful. The riding is amazing. And yeah, it's great. It's just green.
Yeah.
Bring your rain gear. It always rains at least one day at Americade.
Wow, there's a reason it's green, though.
Yeah, but it's beautiful riding. It's a great event. And, you know, try something different. You know, go to an event that's different than what you usually do. That's what I say if you're riding, if you're into bikes, and check it out, or at least just, you know, it's like, listen, like the whole Harley thing and this and that, you know, I joke with them and this and that, but they got some beautiful bikes.
Heck yeah.
They got some beauty, and, you know, if you can polish that much chrome, God bless you, because it looks good, you know, and let's be honest, let's go to the old, you know, yeah, I'm probably misogynistic and a dinosaur and blah, blah, blah. Women love Harleys.
Absolutely.
That's why guys buy them. Women love Harleys. Women love Ducatis. It's
women Italian. Love motorcycles.
It's
women
Italian.
Love
it's
women.
Sexy.
I think women love men who are willing to take a risk and enjoy
it's a
life.
Bit of a, yeah, it's a little bit of a danger thing to it, or they know somebody, or they've been on a bike. But now what's even cooler to me is women like, I don't need you. I'm riding it myself. I love that.
So we'll wrap this up, but I want you to tell the story, the fish out of water story. I brought you to Sturgis for the intro of the Scout.
Sturgis was great.
But tell the story with coming to the party.
So me and Alan Lane, who runs a online magazine called Sport Bike Inc.,
Black Moses.
Yeah, Black Moses. We're the two brothers. We show up at Sturgis. Now, we're there at the very beginning. And help me with her name.
Oh, my God. I forgot. She hated me anyway.
Yeah. But anyway, the rep from Polaris.
She worked in the marketing department.
Marketing department.
Yeah, she was taking care of the, oh, they're fixing the roof while
yeah,
we're doing
I feel terrible not remembering her name.
Jill.
Jill. Yeah. Jill. Blonde white woman. They've got a number of guys there, different marketing, magazine writers, this or that. Alan and I are the only two black guys. We felt like we were the only two black guys at Sturgis. There might have been some more, but we felt like the only two. And we just gave Jill hell. So anything that happened, like if they were serving lunch, and me and Alan would just be, no chicken? Well, you ain't got no chicken? Do you know we were coming? And she's falling apart
because
she's a sweet little woman. And we're like, no watermelon? How come there's what? You got apples? There ain't no watermelon? And she's just cringing every time we do it. But one of the funniest moments, we're walking down the main drag in Sturgis, and it's all these bikes there. And this old biker, old white guy with the beard and the whole thing, he looks at me and Alan, and he's like, good to see you two here. Well, welcome. And we were like, thank you. It was cool. It was funny. It was definitely fish out of water. But that, like, little moments like with that old guy just made it cool, you know? The funniest thing to me in the race world with the bike world, and this is where Harley Davidson, like, they can't put this in an ad, but this is the most amazing thing about Harley Davidson. You have the Black Bike Week, right? Mm-hmm. Which all these brothers from all over the country bring, and it's 98%. It's not just 98% Harleys. It's 98% Road Glides. It is
right.
A specific bike, and these brothers paint them, chrome them. They're beautiful. And they're like, if you ain't got a Harley, you can have a Cowie at home. You can have a Honda at home, but you show up here on a Harley. They love Harleys. And then you have these great white supremacist bike gangs who love Harleys. Like, what kind of product? It's the only product that markets to both of those. You're like, I don't know how this works. But those are, again, that's the extreme.
Well, when you're the market leader, yeah, that's good.
Yeah, Sturgis was always, it was just funny. And the other thing about Sturgis, you know, badass, this and that. Me and Alan walk into a t-shirt shop and we're like, Hell's Angels. Hell's
yeah.
Angels selling t-shirts now? Yeah,
yeah.
Hell's Angels selling t-shirts. So.
Yeah, they got merch. HA's got merch.
Yeah, it was fun though. It was fun, and she survived. And then she's the one who let me drive the slingshot at Americade,
that's
which
right.
was another thing, because this is when the slingshot first came out. They had one on display, and she's like, oh, you want to drive it? And I was like, hell yeah. And she said, oh, go ahead. And I go out, and I'm ripping around these little country roads in mm-hmm. Lake George. And I come back, and she's like, apparently, I wasn't supposed to let you do that.
She made up for it. Well, listen, man, again, I appreciate you spending time talking about motorcycling. I hope we get to do this again, you know, down the road somewhere else, and maybe actually go on a long ride together. That'd be fun.
Yeah, that'd be fun. We'll get to do it again. We used to do it when you did launches. That was fun.
Yeah, I had a budget.
That was part of how I ended up on an Indian. You kept inviting me to ride them. It was like, all right, Robert, I'll fucking buy one.
I had to justify all the budget we blew on you. You know, we had to get you out there. But yeah, you've always been generous with your time and with friends. And I encourage you guys out there listening, visit Alonzo for one of his shows. He's touring all over the place.
AlonzoBoden.com, BODDEN. And we got to get out of here because they're doing construction and I need to eat.
Yeah, it's time to eat. We're going to go grab some Mexican food or something. All right, guys, thanks again for listening. And more news coming up with Give a Shift later on. Catch you guys later. See ya.